This is Autoline After Hours with Peter DiLorenzo, episode 24 for Thursday, September 10th, 2009. Big Ed's Roundup.
Watch Autoline After Hours live at AutolineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline After Hours in the iTunes Music Store.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting chapter of Autoline After Hours. Yes, the inmates are running the asylum. Mr. McElroy is gone in transit, and I am here to run the show tonight. Joining me tonight is Mr. Jim Hall of 2953 Analytics. Jim, how are you tonight?
I'm good. You know, it's not to be confused with 2953 Analytics, our big competitor.
I thought it was 2952 that was your big competitor.
Jim, otherwise known as the man who knew too much, is happy to be here.
Yeah.
We're also joined by Jeff Green. How are you?
Good.
You broke the Magna story, didn't you?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
I had to break the Magna story. That was the condition of my coming back to Detroit. My editor's in New York yesterday.
Oh, okay.
So
what time did you go live with it?
7:05.
All right.
A.M.
Great.
So it was, and right down to the second, too. I was talking to somebody in Berlin who was counting. It was 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Well, glad you could join us. And as always, David Welsh from Business Week. David, how are you?
How's it going, Peter? Good to be here,
Doing well. We sure have a lot to talk about tonight. Let's talk about Opel and Magna. What do you guys think? Jeff, what do you really think about this deal?
Well, I think it was really interesting how it came down to the, in the end, it was what everyone had expected in the beginning.
Yeah.
Except that they managed to figure out a way to get some leverage back over the Germans. I mean, that was all that really happened.
It was the only option.
Yeah.
There was no other option. You know, and part of it is because there were so many players involved. Everybody says, what was between two parties? Well, maybe three. No, it was between five parties that I can think of. Maybe six, because you have to think of IG Metall, the German labor union, almost as a different party involved in this, because it has an influence on the government and seats on the board. I mean, they're the guys with two votes in all of this.
But GM had no options left.
None.
Yeah, well, 2 days after they announced it, Klaus Franz backed them into a corner. They had no choice but to sell a majority stake to get the loans. And all they really did was back the German government a little bit away, back the labor unions a little bit away, and maybe protect their intellectual property from the Russians, you know, maybe. I mean, it's all they really did. And by threatening to keep it, you know, I mean, for 2 weeks, the Germans toned down. They got some things that they needed to make. And in the end, it didn't make any strategic sense to keep it. They needed the volume, but no one probably should have Opel at this point.
Oh, the problem is very straightforward. Opel is effectively Volkswagen without Audi. So it's a high cost of labor nameplate that can right now only sell one car at sticker or premium, the Insignia. Other than that, their cars are discounted and they're the commoditized car in the middle of the European market. That happens for Volkswagen, but they can offset it because a lot of their parts bin is used for stuff at Audi, and Audi gets premium pricing.
Well, let's suppose the German government actually was going to bend and consider giving GM the financing so that they could keep it and restructure it. Who in their right mind would believe that, you know, even with a new board and management, that they're going to get it done right? Because, you know, they've been restructuring this company, you know, for more than a decade now. I don't know how many. Back when Mike Burns was running Opel in the beginning of the decade, every year at the Detroit Auto Show, I sit there in an interview with Mike and say, so when are you going to break even? We think we're going to do it this year. And, you know, it'd be another $1 billion in losses.
But David, bear in mind that the other reason is that there is the contingent in Germany that thinks all of Opel's problems are a direct result of Americans being involved.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, you can read this online at Der Spiegel. And it's astonishing how vitriolic the commentary is. So that there was never an option for GM to remain a majority shareholder because Der Spiegel had a big club. They were swinging around, and they were going after the government with it. I mean, there was no way out. And Angela, you know, 27th is the election, right? And if this went the wrong way, you could have a different government in there.
There was I forget the guy's name on Automotive News who absolutely went off on General Motors.
Mm-hmm.
Forget the reporter's name.
But, well,
German reporter, he's just like, you know.
The really interesting thing here, though, I think, is it appears to be the first deal that I can think of in a long time where the GM board and General Motors didn't get embarrassed in the end. They didn't give $2 billion to Fiat. They had some sense
that was part of this deal at a time. I don't know if you know that. Just as a source, we'll give you the majority and we'll give $2 billion to Fiat again.
Well, but I mean, they came away from this actually looking like they had bargained from they gained some leverage. They got a deal that was better than that we should have gotten. It didn't look like they got chased out of Germany with their tail between their legs. I don't know if this is something that's going to continue, but it didn't seem to be a total embarrassment like a lot of the negotiations that have been.
David, don't you think this is going to prove to be a negative ultimately for GM? I mean,
I don't know. I see a catch-22 here because I don't see how GM could have kept Opel and been competitive and gotten the cost down and turned the thing around. At the same time, you know, you're giving away all that sales volume and control of the company, and you're basically your tool for competition in Europe is going to be Chevy, which is growing pretty nicely.
But it's always going to be a lower end vehicle, so margins are lower.
And there's a real risk with Chevy, and that is, sure, you have lower engineering costs out of Korea, and basically the cars, most of the stuff's assembled over there, and then final assembly CKD, you know, for the European market, it's cheap, or it's assembled in Eastern Europe, it's cheap assembly now, but those costs come up. And, you know, the Koreans, I mean, why is Hyundai coming out with a Genesis and things like that for this market? Because their labor costs are going up over there. They know that, you know, they can't keep the yuan down cheap forever. So, you know, they're going to have a tough time in the long run maintaining their cost advantage. So they're moving up market. So, you know, Chevy's going to be a low market player. Will their costs be low market, you know, forever? You know, they're going to have to move that upscale. But, you know, I don't see how they could have made it with Opel. But I think it is a big loss for them to, you know, to give away control of it too.
But it's a transition. They needed the volume to make those platforms work because they designed them with that volume in mind. So to just get rid of it all at once would have been a problem for everything. This sort of lets some soft landing if the Russians screw it up.
Jeff, there's an argument in some ways that Magna needs General Motors more in some ways than GM needs Opel at a certain level, and they need it to leverage volume because they can use GM's global purchasing power, which is greater. I mean, look at Opel, 1.4, 1.6 million units. Okay, it's a healthy Chrysler. I mean, seriously.
What about the Russian connection? What about Bo? What do you think is going to ultimately happen?
Well, you know, as somebody said, there are a lot of people that don't like dotted connections with anything Russian. But the only thing worse is a hard line connection with something that's Russian. So the dotted line may be a good thing. The truth is they've put in a firewall that's going to be pretty effective because the intellectual property issues come up through 2014. That's
right.
Okay. So what they have is platforms that are already out there. And the platforms they've got out now, you know, let's face it, the new Delta, this new generation Delta is probably an 8 to 10 year platform. So halfway through its life cycle, GM can start work. Before that, they can start work on it with DAT, who's far better at managing costs than Germany. You know, they jointly developed the new small car platform. And the Korean engineering guys showed how some stuff could be done more effectively. They'd show it to the Germans who were doing the replacement for Gamma, and they would nod their heads and ignore most of it.
Yeah, but there's an issue here. And you and I talked about this in the past when this whole thing got hot and heavy. GM could start engineering mid-sized cars in Warren again. They could get small cars and they already get subcompacts out of GM Daewoo anyways, but they could get the compacts out of there. And I talked to a GM executive about that. And what they were really worried about is the compacts that are sold in Asia, they're contented down.
Of course.
And can you bring them up to the level that Americans or Europeans, or, you know, more advanced markets are going.
But David,
to want.
That's the same problem.
That's what they're worried about.
That's the problem that Ford has in reverse. Ford is taking its European vehicles that are contented pretty highly, and they're going to bring them over here and sell them here. And the first thing they have to do is decontent them because of price adjustments. Median transaction price for an Escort in Europe is probably in the mid to high 20s, $27,000. Now let's see an Escort in this country, or a Focus, excuse me, Freudian slip. Because they've got diesels and, you know, they have different, that's a more expensive car. What's the median transaction for a Focus over here? 15 grand, 16 grand, 17 grand?
Yeah, but it's going to have to.
Okay, but it goes up a little bit, Peter, but you're going to be able to take it to 18 grand? Probably not.
It depends on how well the Fiesta does. It depends on the momentum they get with Fiesta and the buy-in that the American consumer
has for those cars. But my concern is that trying to warrant that kind of a price, a transaction price.
It's not going to happen overnight.
No. But the thing is, but when you end up taking a car, and the first thing you have to do is change the content and change the sourcing of materials. For example, you may have a very expensive instrument panel cover that for the U.S. you can't carry the price of the material. You end up having to re-engineer that. So you're spending incremental engineering money for a car you can't get the incremental engineering cost out in price. That's a problem. Where if your cars are low-level engineering, it's easier to trim up. GM found this out with Lambda. Or not Lambda, excuse me, with Epsilon. Because Epsilon was a platform they needed for Europe, they needed for the States, and look at how the contents are different on the two cars. The materials in the Chevy, they optimize the car for the highest volume, price-sensitive, most price-sensitive market, and then you basically add content and improve materials for more expensive markets, like they do in the Insignia.
You can sort of step back from all this and sort of raise a bigger question, and that is, you know, does GM really need to be in the mature Western European market where everyone's beating each other over the head on price and not many companies make much money?
Companies will spend $1.5 billion in hopes that they'll get a tenth of a point market share.
Yeah, and you know, for that matter, and this is something I've written about and I think ranted about on this show, is we've had this big cataclysm in the auto industry, this huge crisis. And the only players that have died were the smallest, weakest, most marginal brands like Pontiac, and even brands that have no right to exist anymore like Saturn and Saab are still alive. And Mitsubishi hasn't left the U.S. market. So you have all these players that are still here. You know, somebody should have been taken out in Europe. Somebody should have been taken out in the U.S. Everything Chrysler has is still going. And what scares me, too, is when you have somebody like Penske buying Saturn or you have somebody like Koenigsegg buying Saab, okay, so we've taken a bunch of capacity out, GM, Chrysler, and Ford have in North America, but you still have these companies owning these brands. And the reason they bought these brands is because they think they can sell more cars than the idiots who used to own them did. And when you have the brand, you want to try to justify it with volume, and it hurts pricing for the players who actually have a right to be in the market because they've proved that right by making money on their cars for years. We didn't lose anybody. Nobody died in this crisis. And the market's not going to come back to 17 million units in the U.S. overnight. So, you know, there's going to be, I think there will still be pricing issues for everybody because they're, you know, still in Europe and the U.S. because there's still too many players.
And speaking of all of this, why don't we shift gears and talk about Saab and Volvo and the Chinese involvement? I mean, you know, we have this interest in Volvo by, what's the name of the company?
Geely. Yeah, Geely.
Okay, but it's actually the holding company, which is actually the government.
Well, of course.
And does anyone really believe that there's anyone over in China up to speed enough to deal with the global brand?
No, but they will hire the expertise they need to manage it. The question is whether they will have a commitment to those people similar to the kind of commitment that Hyundai Kia has to executives in the sales positions in the United States.
Yeah,
I mean, no, seriously, because let's face it, you know, the revolving door there is, we've made you in charge of sales. Good, you're gone in a year and a half.
Oh, yeah, it's like clockwork.
But the Chinese company, there are Chinese companies that have been able to understand it. And the best example is SAIC.
All right.
So, and that's not unique. They understand that their car market is a very different car market.
Which is interesting that they are staying out of all of this. SAIC is staying out. There was plenty of opportunities for them to come in and help General Motors, be General Motors' opportunistic partner, and they stayed out, which says a lot about a lot of these assets' future 5 years from now.
What about the Saab linkage?
Oh, with BAIC? That one's interesting because it's they're buying into the Koenigsegg holding company.
Right.
So they're basically a blind partner, the way the EU sets up stuff. And that actually makes some sense, because if it works, they can get, you know, they'll be the guys who'll say, hey, we want to handle distribution of Saab. Right? And because Saab has a really interesting product line in the pipeline. They actually do. They've got some neat cars they should be doing. But the question is, can they warrant their existence in the current market? Saab used to be these cars that flew outside the hierarchical pyramid of products, in that they didn't fit where size, price was. They were different and full of character. And as they made them more and more normal and brought them into the pyramid, their sales went down.
Well, they lost their reason for being. I mean, Saab, for me, will always be this northeastern brand that was fine where it was. The moment they lost it is when they tried to make it this, you know, broader appeal brand. It's just not going to work.
They ceased being Saabs at one level.
Yeah. And
about 1990, right?
Actually, no. I contend personally that the 9000, even though it was a jointly developed platform, ironically with Fiat.
Yeah, I remember that.
That was still a Saab. When you drove a 9000, it drove like a Saab. It had, it really was a Saab. It was, and Saab were the largest sellers of high-end hatchbacks, and the market globally was pretty good. But in the States, some genius at planning at General Motors that said, they sell more Volvos. Their lineup is sedans and wagons. We should change Saabs to sedans and wagons, and they did. And you saw how the 9.5 just took off.
Look at that.
Yeah, there's a Saab.
Now there's a Saab.
The 9.2 Proto.
What was the probably back in the 70s, the one that had it was like a two-cycle engine that they had?
Well, Saab.
No, that were all Saabs. I mean, when we were going around America's sports car tracks in the 60s, there was always a crazy guy with a Saab.
950 Monte, or 750 Monte Carlo in a 96.
And there was nothing worse than a Saab with an open exhaust at a local sports car.
Tell you what, though, those things were animals in snow.
And oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah.
When I was a kid, we grew up in Syracuse. My dad had one of the last, probably not one of the last, but it was a 70s Chevy Nova with a small block V8 rear drive. Mm-hmm. And you'd have all this snow, and my dad, he was a factory rat, so he left for work before the plow came through, and there was some guy up the street that had one of those Saabs with a two-cycle engine, and kind of went, down the street.
And he'd take off.
And he'd sit there in the driveway waiting for him, and that guy would buzz through the snow like he was in a plow, and then my dad would get in his tire tracks and follow him out of the neighborhood until he got to
Novas
the neighborhood.
Those Novas are great, man. Everyone learned to drive
cool.
Sideways in the snow with a Nova back.
No, what's that?
Saabs were my dad's favorite car until they became what they are now, but I always thought those are the ugliest cars. He's like, yeah.
I thought the designs were cool. I mean, they were quirky.
I thought they were ugly.
The original 96, a friend in high school had a 96 that was lowered with mini lights and these giant CBA Oscar driving lamps in the front. Front bumper was off it, and it was blue-gray, and it looked like a low-flying marauding Zeppelin because of the shape. It was the weirdest thing in the world to see drive quickly.
Hey, I appreciate the whole march to a different drummer aspect. Speaking of marching to a different drummer, why don't we talk about the biggest news of the day? And that's Big Ed Whitaker and General Motors. And I was on, you were, guys were all on the media conference listening in as Bob Lutz explained what they were doing and why. Who wants to go first? David, what's your impression of what GM's doing?
Well, first, I like the total campaign with, the 60-day buyback. I mean, what they're trying to do to assure people and reach out, really push the brands, compare models and really show people, hey, we've got stuff that's comparable fuel economy and good quality and, for less money and this sort of thing. That's good stuff. Putting Ed Whitaker on, I can see the sense in it, and he's an outsider coming in. He's a guy from another part of the country, another industry. He's about as un-Detroit as an executive can get unless you pulled somebody out of Silicon Valley. So he can get on TV and say, I'm an outsider. I'm not the same old Detroit guy who's trying to get you to buy this stuff. Now, do I think this guy is going to resonate with the public and really get attention? Probably not.
He's only going to be
a short window they're going to be using.
It's like a two-week thing.
It's going to be very short. I don't think it's going to hurt him in any way. I don't. But as far as this whole campaign goes, I don't think that's what's going to really get some attention for these guys. The biggest thing about it though is that they're really pushing up ad spend. I mean, and if according to what Bob said, they're pushing it up a lot, and that's been GM's biggest problem. Not only too many mouths to feed, but spending, even if they had not eight brands but four 5 years ago, they were still spending too little money.
Plus, not only that, it had devolved to they weren't selling the nameplate, the brand, or the product. They were selling the deal.
Apparently at some point, Whitaker, one of the first thing he did is he looked at what they were planning to spend, and he's like, are you kidding me? You need to at least double that. I mean, he said that to them. I mean, you just got $50 billion, and you're going to spend $500 million?
There's Big
spend
Ed.
Spend $1.5 billion. I mean?
The only thing that gets me about it is there's an aspect to it that is the page out of the, it's 33 years ago, the page out of the Chrysler deal. With Lee up there talking to folks.
I don't think it's ever going to have the resonance of Lee. I mean, I really do think we're going to have a two-week window with this guy. There'll be some buzz.
I agree, but it's the thinking behind it.
Don't
makes
forget
me think
it was
of that.
Joe Garagiola first.
Get a check and check
Buy
it out.
A car and get a check.
Yep.
It's interesting because, once Detroit went in front of Washington the end of last year, GM, they just turned the ad stuff off. I mean, there was, like David said, there were deals, but that's it.
Well, but they did the recreation of General Motors campaign, which was stupid. Let's advertise the corporation as we go into bankruptcy to remind us and keep it on the news.
And then they ran it right after they emerged, which was really bad. But their ad spending has been way down. There's Lee on the screen right now. Their ad spending has been way down. So they not only have to ratchet up to previous levels, now, as Bob indicated, they're going to ratchet up more. Well, it's going to have to be a lot more. So we'll see how the impact is. And Bob also hinted, oh, well, we're going to stay with this right through 2010.
Well, the next decade is the marketing decade. You can have the best product in a segment, but if you cannot adequately market your merchandise, your car, you're going to be dead in the water.
And that's when GM's going to realize that they, in the U.S. market, they should only have Chevrolet and Cadillac.
What do you think about that Consumer Report survey that said, for whatever reason, and it's Consumer Reports, so to have them saying something positive about American cars makes you a little more believable that Americans are interested in American cars.
Yeah, what was the percentage? Do you remember?
80-some percent were going to at least consider it American. Kind of like, well, maybe we should help. Like, there's a sense out there that they might be able to tap into.
But that's about feeling good about making your decision. I mean, my favorite thing was the old Heartbeat of America campaign at Chevrolet that Campbell Ewald did. They did this campaign, Chevrolet is the Heartbeat of America, and it allowed everybody in the United States, including Honda and Toyota buyers, to feel good about Chevrolet. It's one thing to feel good, because feeling good about a company and answering yes on a survey is free.
Right.
But when I actually have to vote with the portraits of dead presidents, it's really different.
But at least if I'm thinking about maybe going into a dealership to figure out, see what's there.
They're not thinking about it. They're telling you they're thinking about it.
Well, the GM thing is,
you know, a year ago they weren't even thinking about it. I mean, I just, you know.
The GM thing is they desperately need consideration.
Absolutely.
They aren't even on the radar screens for a lot of people. So this is I think it's a Hail Mary play. After this, if this doesn't work,
they're in trouble.
I really believe they're in trouble, and I'll tell you why, because they do have great products.
Yes.
Okay, this 60-day thing, you know, get your money back. The other manufacturers aren't going to follow suit. This is just going to be GM's thing. This is our stake in the ground. We desperately need you to consider us and buy from us. And Bob, hey, I worked on that commercial. What the hell? Anyway, so, you know, this better work.
But conversely, this can't be about consider us GM. It cannot be about consider us GM. It has to be consider us Cruise, consider us LaCrosse. And that's why Whitaker's the chairman of General Motors.
Yeah, but that's why he's only on for 2 weeks.
I know that, but there's an argument in a way that's 2 weeks too much, because that's money that could be spent on advertising the brands and say, consider the brands.
Yeah.
This is about selling cars that don't have a GM chiclet on the side of them anymore. I mean, I remember when they said, we're going to put the little GM logo on the outside of all the cars, and it's like, why?
Nobody at the company could give me an explanation of why.
How many more cars would you sell because of the chiclet?
Well, it'll just be refreshing if they sell things that you can actually go to the showroom and look at. They can't keep showing the CTS Coupe.
Nope.
I love it, but it's a year away.
They can't show the Volt.
They can't show the Volt anymore, and that's why these comparisons are going to be with cars allegedly that you can walk in and buy. I hope they are. Mm-hmm. If they spend a dime one on anything you can't get right now, then they're just blowing it.
See, there's an important piece to this whole story, though, that and Jeff looked at it a second ago, and that is it's what Watts was saying on the call, where, you know, he and Fritz went down to visit with Whitaker in San Antonio, and he was saying, okay, this is a good idea. When are you going to start? And they started talking about, you know, hemming and hawing. Well, you know, we have to worry about budgets and this sort of thing, and when we can roll it out. And he just said, spend it. Just spend it. And what that says is, it's not that the guy is a spendthrift who's just going to rip open the purse strings. But what it does say is he understands that they need to sell their way out of this.
Exactly. And they have no other options.
Yeah.
Because the product is right. They've got the product in line, which is where they need to be.
And inside the company, he's hammering about sales and market share and revenue. You know, so you finally have someone at the top of the company who really understands that. And you could argue that people at GM have understood that in the past, but because of union contracts and healthcare costs and every other thing that they've
learned about it.
I don't think they've understood the execution for sure, but they may have. They may have never had the opportunity because they were so worried about, you know, making the next quarterly earnings and, you know, paying the bills and that sort of thing. I mean, you know, look. I'm not making an excuse for these guys, but the healthcare burden and the union contracts and you know, discounting cars to keep people busy because they couldn't close the factories or lay people off without paying them most of their salary, all of this stuff really, it affected every single business decision that they made.
Of course.
Yeah, the last 15 years was all about the break-even point and how do you sell enough cars to keep revenue.
Keep paying the bills.
Yeah. And those days are over. So if they're going to sell their way out, they've just officially started the clock.
The important thing here, too, is if this campaign doesn't exactly hit it, at the very least, like Bob said, they're going to keep the raised level of spending sustained through the end of next
year.
Okay,
but stop and think about that. If we're spending more with totally ineffectual commercials, we're burning cash.
Well, we'll see how they do.
I know, but I'm saying,
agreed.
But if it's just
how do you
about
measure
the spend,
that? I mean, you know, it's. I mean, the one thing that I know.
How do you measure it? Consideration goes up.
It's good.
Dealers
point.
Close deals.
Good point.
That's how you measure it.
Yeah.
Right, but you know, look, you know how many generations of product it takes to turn around a car brand.
But you see, here's the irony of it. General Motors, if you think about it, you've got Gen Y out here as a bunch of buyers, and they do not, when they buy a car, when they think about cars, they do not bring the baggage that their parents have, that, you know, geez, GM cars are crap, or so what, domestic cars are garbage. To these guys, Camrys are domestics too, because all their life they've been built in this country. These guys are a tremendous opportunity for any one of the domestics to go after if they could figure out how to talk to them and get the product right. It's a huge opportunity, and none of the big three have quite figured out that that's their business opportunity.
Well, we've talked about this before, that their kids grew up and they never had an American car in their driveway, at least an American.
Right, American
source.
Branded vehicle.
Yeah.
And they don't have the baggage.
Yeah, and so, yeah, and I wrote about this about 7 years ago on Auto Extreme. I said, why aren't you guys going after that? Figure out how to get these people who don't necessarily want to drive their parents' cars.
If we had a clever General Motors, the Scion XB would have been a Chevrolet.
Not the current Scion XB, that's bombing.
I'm talking about the first car,
yeah.
The car that actually said, because look, if it's bombing, it has a lot of people that are following the vehicle. Nissan, Kia.
Well, I think they're following the first vehicle. The second gen, I think Toyota screwed up.
Yet the irony is the second car is a much better car to drive than the first one.
But I know,
it lost the character in the buyers. The traditional buyer doesn't like it. But they gave the buyers, they gave the XB owners everything they asked for. I want a little more space. I want more power.
I think the Cube and the Soul are actually a better execution of the XB.
The Soul, to me, is the car that's outstanding right now in the segment. It has problems, but it's chock full of character.
So is the Cube. I think
Cube.
Peter had one.
Cube's feminine.
Yeah, I mean, Janice, Word Girl, a.k.a. Word Girl, wrote the review. And she drove it, and she loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone raves about the Soul.
Yeah.
But you know, it's interesting. We're having this conversation about what GM needs to do to solve itself, and nobody's talking about any General Motors vehicles whatsoever. Is
well,
let's
remind people, what are the best GM vehicles right now? Okay.
CTS.
CTS, CTSV.
Malibu.
Equinox.
Definitely.
Equinox is a home run in my mind.
The Lambdas, the Acadias.
Yeah, Buick Enclave. I think
Enclave.
Yeah, the best one, too.
Well, I have to throw in the ZR1 just because. I mean,
yeah, but the ZR1 is a psycho car. I still say it would be really hard to do the ZR1 wrong if you had a guy like Lutz pushing you to do all the stuff they did.
No, I like the Corvette, so that has to count.
Yeah.
And the SRX.
The Cruze, which is coming soon, has the potential to be a really, really, really interesting car, especially the cars with the SIDI turbo engines and the 6-speed autos.
Yeah.
That's going to be a very interesting package.
Yeah, I hear that.
If Chrysler had built the PT Cruiser and there was anything else that people could have bought when they came in to get the PT Cruiser, it seems like that's what GM doesn't have, is that one vehicle that people come. I mean, the Malibu is
a magnet car.
The Malibu is a great car. The Lambdas are great cars. I mean, I had somebody email me today who said, you know, I haven't been in a. He drives a Highlander. I haven't been in a. This is one of the Bloomberg employees. I haven't been in an American car, but I rented an Acadia, I think it was. He's like, I'm going to price one out. This is kind of cool. But what brings them in that it is, you know, like.
Where's the magnet car?
Yeah. I mean, it's not the Camaro.
I think
really.
The Enclave's a magnet car.
I agree. And you could see in how the Enclave buyer was a buyer that was not a Buick buyer as defined by previous Buicks. I mean, let's face it. Buick got to the point where the Buick Century was the only car named after the target demographic group's age, and it was correct. Okay? You know, so they had to change the name because they were all dying.
Well, the brand that really needs the magnet car. It's Cadillac. They don't really have one. They don't have a flagship, and they don't have a magnet car within the brand.
Yeah, but they don't.
Chevy's got a Camaro now. I mean, you could also say they've got a Corvette. Although, you know, we've talked about those issues before, where people don't see the Corvette as a Chevy.
No, but that to me is Chevy's problem, because Chevy at one time completely disconnected the Corvette from Chevrolet. There's always been a natural DNA connection between certain models of Chevrolet and the Corvette, and it used to be exploited that way. And they suddenly thought,
back when they had a.
Well, that was the mindset that there's a little bit of Corvette in everything we sell.
Right.
And so the family guy who comes down or woman comes down to the dealer to see a Malibu. They love looking at the Corvette, and they end up driving away with something, even though they can't afford a Corvette.
Exactly.
That was it's been that way since beginning this business.
But Chevy made some conscientious decision to disconnect the Corvette from the rest of Chevrolet. And it was an absurd strategy. It looked like it was in the late 80s or early 90s.
You think the Camaro can be the magnet car for the brand?
Well, I put it this way. Right now, it has to be.
Yeah, it's doing that job right now. I don't know how long it'll last. I think the Equinox, if the word of mouth on an Equinox really grows, that has potential to be a really great vehicle for Chevrolet.
Yeah, but not a magnet vehicle.
That's what I'm saying. These are all great cars.
Well, magnet
Once
vehicles,
you get somebody
you know,
in
a magnet vehicle
them.
Can be an appliance if it's properly done. Magnet vehicle for Honda? Civic SI.
Well, the next gen, the CRX or whatever.
Well, the magnet for
CTX,
Honda is the H
whatever
on
they've
the
got
car.
Coming.
I mean, and Toyota, the same thing.
But the thing is, Honda had cars like that that brought younger buyers in, that got them interested in it. And a lot of them went out, they'd come in looking at a hot Civic and they couldn't get it, so they'd get a regular Civic. It was a magnet car to draw certain people in. It was a visibility vehicle. You know, Honda even screwed the pooch in a way on their visibility car in that the S2000 never did that. And it should have.
Even though it's one of my all-time favorite
Right, but the thing
cars.
Is, it never really had that effect in the market.
It's too bad because, you know, anyone who knows about cars, loves cars, the S2000 has to be right up
it's
there.
It's a grin car.
Yeah, it's a
it
great...
It was a lot of fun to drive.
Oh, it's a sweet
You know, the
car.
Miata is a magnet car for Mazda, or it had been. And then Mazda sort of diluted everything for a while. I mean, there was a time when the Mazdas had character, and then they did that absolutely horrific predecessor to the Mazda 6. It was the taxicab 626 that... You know, I mean, it was the most appliance-like car you could probably buy in the States. And the Miata couldn't even work with that.
Right.
So they had to spice up their other cars to get traction again.
Do you remember the titanium shifter knob on the S2000?
Yes.
And if you parked the car in the sun with the top down on a hot day and you came back and you needed an oven mitt in the glove box?
No, I simply would drive with welding glove. You know, I'm going to...
So what's the net-net on this new GM campaign? Do you give it thumbs up or the new direction? Do you give it thumbs up, Joe?
Well, I think the fact that they seem to be trying a new direction aggressively, I mean, what we
They've
did...
They've got no choice, I mean, but yeah.
But I mean, we have two companies that just came out of bankruptcy. One decided to go quiet and go dark and say nothing at the one time anyone's paying attention. The other one is, you know, hey, look at me, at least, when people are still looking. It maybe have been a bankruptcy, but the whole world is focused on what's going to happen with this bankruptcy right now.
But the difference is GM has the product. Chrysler does not.
Yeah. Chrysler has nothing. What do you think, David?
Look... I'm going to give GM benefit of the doubt on this one because, they're pushing product very aggressively and they're stacking it up against the competition. They're spending a lot more money, and they're doing the sort of assurance things that have worked very well for Hyundai and Kia when they were trying to come up as brands. So, you know, overall, I think it's a good thing. The Whitaker thing, I think, is sort of a ball and a strike, and I don't think it's going to last long enough to either help them or do any damage. I sort of – it's not irrelevant because it shows a lot about Whitaker being willing to get in front of the camera.
We like that.
You know, the guy's got some moxie. You know, it's all fine. But in terms of pushing their brands and everything, you know, it's...
And his theme music, we've coined his theme music, you know.
I got spurs that jingle, jangle, jingle.
So every time you watch a spot, just think of this music. And all of a sudden, boy, I like that spot.
Well, I'll tell you though, San Antonio's a great town.
Oh, Bob Lutz describing him today. I don't know. I was just like, wow. I mean, these
guys, it was unbelievable. It was like... what is it, your salary drive, Bob, or what the hell's going on there?
You know, Feinberg gets to limit that, so I don't know what he's going for.
I actually think, you know, GM's got their backs to the wall. They've got some excellent products. They had to do something. It's a Hail Mary pass. The 60-day car return thing, that's really not the thing. That'll be here and gone and instantly.
He said they'll probably extend it, though.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, we'll see. You know,
but it's these comparison spots. If they can get the people off the couch and say, hey, you know, I might go look at that because you know what? It gets better mileage. It's cheaper. You know, whatever it is that gets them off the couch. So GM had to do it. I applaud them giving it a
My concern is that the Whitaker spots basically keep the sort of spotlight focused on something other than the brands and product. And that's my only concern about it, because they have got to do it. The comparisons are aggressive. They really are. And they're using real cars. I mean, you're not going to see a Cruze in the comparison spot because you can't get a Cruze yet. But you are going to see LaCrosse. You're probably going to see Terrain. You're definitely going to see Equinox. You're going to see the products that are their really significant products.
This is like that Malibu campaign from the late 90s, the car you always knew America could build. And the problem is that it was the car you always knew America could build, and it was terrible. But this time, they've actually got the product.
But the head of market research said that he was proud that that was General Motors' most clinicked car of all time.
Hey, anytime I hear the word research in General Motors, I got to tell you, their internal research, forget about it.
It's horrible.
It is absolutely forget about it. And if they talk about it in any like a media conference today, our research said it's ding, ding, ding. Don't tell me that, because I don't want to hear about it, because your research sucks and has for 15 years.
No, because the research brought us products like the P90 Malibu, you know? That's the thing. Their own research is an indictment. Whenever they said it was heavily researched, I thought the idea of doing research was so your cars were successful in the market, okay? Apparently, GM used it to guarantee something less than success.
Who was that guy?
Vince Barabba.
Well, they changed their marketing campaign to Chevy to "We'll be there." I mean, it's like
Chevy hasn't had. Look, Chevrolet has been good or bad. It was America's brand for
absolutely
a long time. See the USA.
Heartbeat of America was a great campaign.
See the USA. Baseball hot dogs, hokey, but at the time it was perfect. Heartbeat of America was absolutely perfect for the times, and it was superbly executed. At my alma mater agency, they did a tremendous job with it. They haven't had another campaign since.
You're right.
That has resonated. Well, they desperately need that campaign.
And you saw the American Revolution was one that they thought would.
It was doomed
from the start.
I couldn't stand it. It just didn't make it.
Well, the point you made about Ed Whitaker on camera, I mean, at the very least, there are probably some people in America would like to just hear GM say, thank you. You know, and I mean, get away from the embarrassment of, we flew here in jets.
That should have been their coming out of bankruptcy ad, not a TV commercial that shows people getting on a subway train.
Actually, you know, well,
I remember being at a press conference at the Rensen 4 or 5 years ago, and GM showing us full page ads, and I think the Times, the Journal, and USA Today basically apologizing for past quality mistakes and saying, They've been apologizing for a long time. That's why I think they got to do the Whitaker thing quickly and then get into the brand. One more observation about here I want to make about this, because I think this is interesting. We've got Whitaker obviously applying pressure to Ray Young, which we're going to talk about.
Well, he said 90 days.
Yeah. So he wants to see results in sales, market share, revenue.
In 90 days.
And he's putting heat on people. Now, Bob and Fritz sat down at his place in San Antonio, and he said, spend the money. So he told him to spend the money on this campaign. And he's getting in front of the camera. So if this doesn't work, he can't just beat up the operational execs. He owns this thing, too. He can't go to the rest of the board and say, yeah, you guys are right. These guys are clowns. Well, he owns a big chunk of this.
Yeah,
thing.
I know, but some guys are going to get jettisoned.
If I was doing, I probably
would have put Big Ed on a porch with his jeans on, his boots up, and he said, you know, something like that.
Lonesome Roads.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Lonesome Roads didn't do well.
No.
It'll be like Clint Eastwood from Unforgiven.
Deserves got nothing to do with it.
Yeah. So let's talk about a completely different subject.
And what about GM moving, you know?
Oh, well, we were going to talk about that. Jeff weighed in via email. GM's not moving. Why are we even talking about that? There was a rumble about GM's moving some OnStar people to Warren.
Well, Fritz Henderson isn't moving to Warren. I mean, maybe, you know, in the end, the symbolic center of General Motors is still going to be in the Rensen. Maybe it'll be a really...
Even though they're just the worst offices.
But you stop and think about it. They bought the Rensen for a nickel on the dollar, functionally.
Well, let me back up for our viewers.
Oh, yeah.
GM once was on West Grand Boulevard in Detroit. It was probably one of the most elegant office buildings, just beautiful to look at. Then they were hand-wringing. They had property right next to their huge technical center in Warren, all ready to go. They were going to move there. And then the Rensen, the Renaissance Center, which sits hard by the Detroit River in our town.
And was originally heavily funded by Henry Ford II,
and was used
by Ford for their divisional headquarters for the brands.
And it came up for sale, and it was such a deal that someone said, gee, maybe we ought to buy that. And they've spent, what, $600, $700 million on it?
In the renovation.
Yeah, they bought it for $65 million or $71
million. 70, something like that, yeah.
And then they've spent $650 million on it and really transformed it.
It's an amazing facility.
Yeah. Now, back then, it was just a nightmare. But still, the offices are less than ideal. So a rumor started that maybe they were going to consolidate all of GM employees at the tech center where they have plenty of office space. Mm-hmm. And that's been poo-pooed. They are going to move OnStar, but no one expects them. We don't expect them to move.
Well, the question is, if they move, then what do they do with the rents then?
You know, because they still own it.
They would still own it. Who is going to buy it? And they're not going to buy it for the money they have into it. That definitely won't happen. And then who are you going to get to fill the office
space? Sounds like marketing may move over the Rensen, over to Warren, ostensibly to be closer to the product, but probably so Bob doesn't have to go somewhere without a helicopter landing pad to meet with these people. But I mean, that does
I would even be surprised if that happened.
I've heard that might happen. You know, move those people closer to the product.
I'll believe it when
like
I see
that.
It. But let's talk. Let's shift gears. Let's talk about the luxury market as it applies to the German manufacturers. I really think right now, despite Mercedes making a lot of noise in Frankfurt, you know, we've got our green stuff on, we've got, you know, we got it going on. I really think Mercedes is now number three behind BMW and Audi.
If you go back and look at...
Perception-wise.
You go look at nameplate consideration in the United States, and you look at it from about 1996... to 2006, which is the last year of pure numbers before you had the economic decline, and you saw that two brands in that period trended their consideration up, BMW and Lexus. Mercedes was flat and started to decline, and then Audi started to climb. So you have Mercedes consideration going down as they increase. Look at Mercedes volumes. They stay up because they keep adding models.
I left Lexus out, but I kind of wanted to just...
I understand, but I'm
German
saying
thing.
The consideration, though, was such that at that time, the two first-tier... there were three first-tier luxury brands at that time, and they were Lexus, BMW, right. And Mercedes. And you saw that two of them were having increased consideration. One was flat and then declining, and that was Mercedes. They kept their volume up by adding product.
Well, they were distracted with that thing... Chrysler that's now going to distract Fiat.
What do you guys think? Do you think that this is just me, you know, thinking, or do you think that there's something to...
Well, Audi made an A8 that you wouldn't be embarrassed to... You wouldn't have to explain to your BMW driving neighbor why you bought it.
Well, Audi's been on an upward trajectory.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, and Mercedes has been, I think, really was hurt a lot by the distraction of trying to...
Well, they were hurt a lot about that. They were... decimated by their quality issues.
Absolutely.
The nav screens that were having to be replaced for $7,000 a pop.
Yeah. And the fact that they had an interface that you had to have a lesson to know how to use, the early command system was...
That's right.
Yeah, it was horrific. You had electrical problems on the generation, the outgoing generation E-Class. Had weird electrical problems at the start. They had an S-Class that was Shrempian logic at its best. Be able to take cost out of the interior. And they did. So we took cost out of our flagship interior in the car that people live in. You go to the interior and go, why am I getting this? Mm-hmm. And then they diluted their own nameplate globally by poaching Mercedes at the two ends. One, we'll add Maybach.
Yeah, Maybach.
That's what I was going to bring
up. But it's part of the equation, Peter. That's the point.
Yeah.
And in the other end, we'll do smart and A-classes. And literally, they took this brand that was the global premium luxury nameplate. It was in a position that was arguably higher than Rolls-Royce.
I remember having...
And they nibbled away at it at both ends.
I remember having this discussion with Dieter. I said, Dieter, look, you know, for the longest time, Mercedes was engineered like no other car in the world. It was one of the great ad themes. They never should have walked away from it.
And it was true, though.
And it was true, because they over-engineered the hell out of their cars. And it was the engineer said, this is what we do, and you figure out how to sell it later. And that was fine. It worked. But I was telling Dieter, I said, Dieter, you know, there's still a lot of that lingering halo, even though you've screwed it up pretty bad, in this market. So you start bringing in like that, what was that little, the little Mercedes, the coupe they brought?
Oh, you mean the Mercedes CRX? No, I'm sorry. Yeah. It was the coupe version of the C-Class.
I mean, I remember having this conversation with Dieter. I said, Dieter, you know, we don't perceive Mercedes like that. Even though you screwed up, you still have a lingering halo here that Mercedes is Mercedes-Benz.
Well, they ditched that car before the end of the life cycle on the C-Class.
Well, I know, but I said you start bringing in these, you start going down market, Dieter, it's not going to go well for you.
That's why the B-Class was a disaster from the start.
Yeah, and then he said, well, yeah, but, you know, in Germany we have sell trucks, we sell taxis. I said, that's Germany. That doesn't work over here. And he, you know.
They also had so accelerated their product plan with more and more models without significantly increasing their engineering ability. So people were being worked harder. The ranks got really thin on the bench. And you saw it in their products.
They lost their specialness.
Absolutely.
I think they've lost their way with design, too. Design is subjective. I don't think their cars are great looking. But I think the other problem is the theme isn't very common.
But understand
between
why.
The different nameplates. And at BMW it is. The car in BMW does it the best because you don't have three sizes of the sausage anymore at BMW.
You have three different BMWs that are all BMWs.
Yeah. You can tell they're BMWs, but they look different. They absolutely do it perfectly.
But
the other thing BMW has done really well that Mercedes has screwed up, which you're just talking about, is to get the smaller cars and reach down, BMW not only brought Mini over, but they don't say this is Mini by BMW in the way that Smart was connected to Mercedes.
Right.
They're even in the same showroom, and people like us know that they're made by the same company.
The customer makes the connection.
Yeah, the customer
does.
They
don't do it.
They don't talk about it at all.
Understand something. You've talked about design because it's subjective, but if you go back and look, you had a lot of consistency at BMW with design management. You didn't have it at Mercedes. You had rotating chief designers there, and each one would get in, and the first thing they wanted to do, the first car up, I was going to put my mark on. And that's why you saw cars like the last S-Class and the C-Class that had some familial look to them, but not a lot. And then they went to the next generation cars, and it's like they're different. You had the CLK go from one look that was sort of a Bruno Sacco look, the first generation CLK, to the second generation CLK that was sort of a messy disaster, but it was a coupe, so it was okay. And they kept unwinding because they haven't had consistency at the top of design.
You know, that the E-Class that they did in the late 90s with the round headlights really caught a lot of attention. It was a classic design, but it was also modern at the same time. Mm-hmm. People loved it. I remember it was when I was covering autos, I think, for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and it was one of my first press cars, and I pull up to baseball practice in this thing, and we're sort of warming up, and guy said to me, he goes, you know, I was swinging a new bat. He goes, how much did you pay for that? And I said, I think it was about $200. And he goes, and he's looking at the bat, and then he looks over at the car, and he goes, that's $200 more than you paid for that. What the hell is that? And the guys like flocked over, and this E-Class was the hottest thing. All these guys around, and it was a great-looking car at the time. And the second one still had those headlights, and they've sort of gone away from that theme. Mm-hmm. And that really is the car. I mean, the S-Class is the flagship, but the E-Class is really the car that they should make a great statement with because it's volume and it's prestige at the same time.
Well, they have.
And this one looks really, the current E-Class to me looks like a Camry.
Well, the new E-Class is just hitting.
Yeah, and it's
got the hip thing going.
It's a mess.
Yeah. Well, I'll wrap this up, but I really believe that Mercedes is really sucking wind right now. And Audi has come on. They've had this focus consistency for 10 years. They said, we will go to Le Mans. We will win. We will not deviate from this. We don't care how much it costs. And all of a sudden, here they are.
Remember, though, the guys at Mercedes at the helm are the guys that brought us the Chrysler Corporation that gave us the Chrysler Sebring.
Right. Well, let me just say, I think they should bring back engineered like no other car in the world and do it.
They have to do it.
And I also wrote this week that Cadillac should go back to the standard of the world, even though the world's changed, even though no one will ever admit that they will get there. They need something to shoot at, put their stake in the ground, and say, we are going to be the standard of the world, and we're going to engineer and design and execute our cars over, you know, over expectations. We're going to do this. I believe if they do that, even though they might not get there, it might work out.
Because it'll make them work harder.
And it's not embarrassing for them to say it now that they've got something. They've got two generations of CTS.
Yeah, they've gotten to the level of respectability. Now they need to take it to the next level. It's time for rapid fire. Ben, run the...
This graphic is...
Run the graphic.
Yeah, I thought the graphic.
It's Tom Cruise with it. Oh, you missed it. It's Tom Cruise, the AK-47.
I saw it.
Uh-oh. Let's see. Boy. Joseph asks, I assume we all read that Ford is going to try and sell the new Taurus to police departments. Will they agree to make Tauruses with a column shifter? And why don't more cars have a column shifter option? It gives a car the three-across seating option. Well, we missed that aspect of it. But what do you guys think?
They're going to do a column shift for the police pack. They're also going to have to re-engineer and redesign a fair amount of the center stack because it sweeps back. So it's not an inconsequential investment for them. The problem is a lot of police departments, plain and simply, do not want unit body police cars.
Right.
So it's going to be academic.
They want body on frame.
Body on frame because they can use them as Rams. I mean.
Okay. Ride with Wes on Twitter asks, Buick vehicles, portholes, yes or no, stay or go, ads or detracts, David?
I like the portholes, and I think Buick, of all the brands, has to really stand out with design and character because that's really all they've got. I mean, they're not luxury, and they're not common man cars. They've got to be aggressively designed. They're not shooting for much volume, so they can even piss some people off with an overly aggressive design. Yeah, go
what
for it.
What do you think, Jeff?
Well, I mean, I think they ought to be experimenting with Buick. They basically kept it for some reason. Although now they have nothing to lose. I mean, it's really not about the United States anymore anyway. So they might as well just go for broke. They certainly don't want any more Lucernes or LaCrosses or anything like that. They shouldn't even bother.
Well, the new LaCrosse is pretty okay.
Yeah, I mean the old one.
Although I talked to an old friend of mine last night who's a Buick dealer, and he said, you know what? For all their pronouncements about Lucernes, I'd love a boatload of them right now. Mm-hmm. And he was saying they got nothing to sell, and he's worried, and he should be worried. Mm-hmm. Let's see.
And they're Venta ports. They're not portholes.
See, Backus on Twitter asks, Bob Lutz is challenging journalists to race him in any car against his CTSV. What would you drive to challenge him? First of all, he's not going to drive the car.
Yeah, I understand that. And it'll be Heinrichsy, and so you're dead to begin with.
Yeah.
you're dead. A Veyron.
But it's got to be in that class.
Well, we said any car.
Okay, never mind.
No, I'd pick a CTSV. I'd go match for match. CTSV is an astonishing car. Every time I get out of one, I cannot believe that it's as good as it really is.
Yeah.
I'd go up against him in an M5.
M5 would lose.
You would lose.
I know, but... You know, you want to see what a competing model can do. I don't care if I win the race or not. I don't have any skin in the game. I just want to drive the car and see what I can do against.
Jeff, what would you?
I'd stay off the track. Okay. Guys.
Jeff would be on BlackBerry.
My friend Goat Rope asks, does NASCAR need Danica Patrick more than she needs NASCAR? This is a racing question. Our viewers tend to hate racing, but John and I like it.
Truthfully, NASCAR needs Danica Patrick more than she needs NASCAR.
I absolutely agree. NASCAR is desperate for Danica because without Danica, NASCAR has to look within themselves and fix their thing.
That's murderously tough.
Yeah, that's murderously tough for them.
Truthfully, NASCAR needs an on-site dentist at all the races.
He's dissing the South.
There goes the South theme.
See, you're dissing the South.
Oh, Espo, Peter or Jim, always wondered why in a car ad the road is always wet. Oh, boy, I could do a whole show on this. But when directors go out in the middle of the desert and it's 130 degrees, visually, a dampened down road looks nicer.
It reflects some of the car.
Yes, and it looks nicer. And, boy, you run the hell out of water trucks doing it. But remember when Hal Reiney took over Saturn, he said, you will never see a car on a windy road because that's the stereotype back then. But what did Hal Reiney do towards the end? There was a
Saturn. Client might have been asking for it.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's why they do that.
Because you get reflection of the car in it. It adds depth to the picture and contrast.
That's why even you watch on TV shows that these weekly series, you see it's, 110 degrees and sunny in L.A., but the road is wet. Well, that's why.
They're trying to humidify LA, yeah. For the people that...
And thus that warning on the bottom of the screen, closed track, don't try this, because it's...
Mud Monster 37, who's different from Mud Monster 33, but why is the U.S. market so barren of hot hatchbacks like the Focus RS and Civic Type R? Why are we not allowed to have this forbidden fruit? Well, I think we're going to get some of those, and wasn't Ford seriously investigating bringing over
the... There's a problem with the Focus RS.
We were talking about the BMW 5...
GT.
The GT with the hatchback, and you guys were ripping it last week.
It's a different kind of car.
That's a different car. We're talking about the smaller hatches.
Like a Golf. The reason's pretty straightforward. They're looking
at
the ST.
Can you give a Mazda 3 hatch?
The problem with the ST, Focus ST, is very straightforward. They may lose the engine. It's a Volvo engine.
Right.
But why they don't do it is plain and simply, look at Volkswagen sales, and you look at Golf and Jetta, same car. All right? 80 to 90% notchbacks. 15 to 10% hatchbacks. Hatchbacks just don't have traction in this market.
Yeah, right.
They're cool. I like them, but that should automatically. Yeah, I
like them too.
Ask the BMW guys, when are you going to bring a hatchback, and they change the subject immediately.
Well, they start saying, you know, we have a coupe version of the one series.
You could argue the Mazda 3 hatch is cooler than the sedan.
The Mazda 3 isn't cool anymore because of that incredible Peugeot eating grin it has now.
I like it.
Oof. Okay, Wright Knight asks, is GM's Alpha platform still on, Jim?
Sort of. They're going to do a smaller rear-wheel drive platform. So, yeah, they've got a vehicle coming. They're playing around with the name ATS, and it looks pretty okay.
Okay.
Coupe, convertible, and four-door.
Yep.
Pedro Fernandez asks, will GM be able to make a profit by building a subcompact here instead of in Mexico like Ford is doing with the Fiesta? They better hope they can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's like
if they can't. If any time in their history they were going to have a shot at it, it better be the next before the next UAW contract.
That plant next week.
I'm aware of that. Yes. Yes, he is.
Yes.
Yeah, that's then. You know, let's face it. They're going to build their cruise derivative more than likely the Buick. And they're going to also build there. They're going to do a. What's the other car? I've just had a brain burp.
Aren't they doing the European
the European Astra and the
van and thing from
the Orlando?
Yeah, isn't that
the Orlando is still out TBD where it's going to go?
Subcompact from GM Daewoo coming the Spark,
probably not built here.
Yeah.
Jim Haynes asks, with the new Chrysler tossing out Hyundai and Mitsubishi deals with engines, how long will it be until Chrysler severs ties with Mitsubishi on cars, and where will that leave the Mitsu's already grossly underused assembly plants? If not the whole Mitsubishi North America.
They've period. Already yeah, done that.
Been there, done that, already
yeah,
over.
The last car they got out of there were the Avenger, well, not Avenger, what was it? It was the Sebring Coupe and the, they're gone. So they have no relationship with Mitsu anymore.
Jim also wants to know what we think of the Cube, and that we had that discussion earlier. Michael Weber wants to know what Jim and I think of the Nelson Piquet Jr. intentional crashing story. We don't have enough time to talk about that.
No, it's absurd. There's stuff going on in Formula One that I love because it makes the circus more entertaining, and then every now and then there's one of those chuckle-headed moves like that, and it's like, come on, please.
Yeah. What do you guys, I meant to talk about this earlier, what about the new McLaren? This is what I think about. David, you're aware of the new McLaren M412C supercar that they just announced. It's coming out in 2011. This is a car McLaren is going after Ferrari and Lamborghini. And I will tell you, here's a picture of it right here. I will tell you that if I were Ferrari and Lamborghini, I would be seriously concerned because McLaren, first of all, they're not talking about chasing emerging markets like Ferrari and Lamborghini are. And they're slowly increasing their production, which I don't like. Used to be Ferrari only made 4,000 cars.
Ferrari was exclusivity.
Yeah. This McLaren, the engineering, the technical expertise, there's not one thing on that car that's made outside the company. The exclusivity, we are looking at a new era of supercars in the world, and the McLaren is going to eclipse Ferrari as the most desirable supercar. That's what I think. What do you think?
Go ahead.
Yes and no. No, because Ferrari has such a big base of people that are just going to be enthusiastic about Ferrari.
I love Ferrari, so don't get me wrong.
But for a very thin piece of clientele, they will be able to eclipse them. I mean, the truth is they've been eclipsed now for exclusivity by the Veyron. They really have.
Well, right.
They have. And the question is going to be volume here. What kind of volume will they be able to do with this vehicle and get it the way they want it? What's their max output?
They said that they won't go over 4,000.
Right. And in this economy, I think they have a while before they'll get up to that rate.
At 240,000.
Yep.
I think the McLaren name obviously has enough credibility to do it. I would I think Jim's right about Ferrari. I think Lamborghini would be more exposed here because it's, you know,
Lamborghini. Oh, I think Lamborghini is definitely more exposed of the two.
Yeah, they you know, they sell sort of pure horsepower, not
Lambo
as well
products
styled.
Have a tendency to hit a point and plateau. They really do.
Don't we need like an economy or a psyche that's welcoming to something like this? This seems like the absolute worst time to be trying to promote excess.
For $4,000 a year, Peter, we need a better economy than we've got, global economy that we have now.
It'll be
what
out,
we need is
but we're talking about 2011.
Not just a better economy, though. You need a better
need a stock market bubble.
Yeah, well, you need a whole. You need some euphoria. It needs to be okay to spend money again and to display wealth.
Yeah, we've got irrational exuberance.
We've talked about that. I think that will slowly. That will slowly give away. I think, you know, the days of people getting pitchforks out because you're driving a nice car, that's not never going to happen.
Don't people know that, I mean, the SOR was McLaren?
I don't know. I'm hearing stories of Porsche dealers saying people are coming in and buying the exact same car so that their neighbors don't
know
they
got
a new one. Yeah. I mean,
the interesting thing with the McLaren is that they there's a pre-sale in the old McLaren F1, and there are a bunch of cues on the vehicle that are common with the F1 and sort of evolved, which is brilliant on their part. So they can make that connection to that vehicle that was a unique car in the marketplace. Absurdly expensive, very limited production. So they have the exclusivity there and say, now you want a McLaren? Hmm.
So it'll be interesting to see the Comparo test between the 458 Italia Ferrari and the...
I will raise my hand to do the review.
Of a sudden, hey, it's not so bad, hey. All right, well, we've reached the end of the road. Little
that's
Dogies.
So sad.
Little Dogies, it's that time of night.
What's that? He's back.
Yeah.
Right out of Central Casting.
I'd like to thank Mr. Jim Hall.
Thank you, sir.
David Welch. Jeff Green.
Peter.
Sitting around the campfire tonight. You can follow David's work by visiting the AutoBeat blog at Business Week.
Or just go to businessweek.com.
Or just go to businessweek.com. Jeff, are you on Twitter or Facebook?
Not officially.
Good.
But you can go to Bloomberg.com or pay $20,000 for one of our terminals.
Oh, okay.
Oh, a terminal.
How about you, Jim? Are you anywhere but
yes.
In space?
Yes.
Where are you?
I'm on Facebook.
Okay.
You're on Facebook?
Damn right.
I'll be friending you on the way home. Not while driving, of course, Ford Motor Company.
No, of course not. But with sync, can't you do it verbally?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
So you can visit my website, of course, at autoextremist.com or follow me at twitter.com/autoextremist, even though I rarely appear there. You can follow Autoline, of course, on Twitter at twitter.com/autoline. And don't forget, you can also friend Autoline on Facebook to get all kinds of content throughout the week.
Become a fan.
Yeah, you can find Autoline's page at facebook.com/AutolineDetroit.
So Jim, are you one of these people with like 400 pictures of yourself on your Facebook
page? No. Very few pictures of myself. Some other amusing things, and every now and then.
With like 1,000 friends on there?
No.
And thanks,
I have two friends.
And thanks to everyone out there joining us live. We'll see you next week for another Autoline After Hours, and good night, Big Ed, wherever you are.
Keep rolling along.
Visit our website, AutolineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more at AutolineDetroit.tv.